Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Now, I want you to pay close attention because starting tonight, I'm going to be hitting you with some heavy-duty facts about the criminal, unconstitutional, unlawful liars, hoaxers, defrauders known as the Internal Revenue Service. That includes the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, by the way. And there appears to be some link with the Secret Service. Now, well, I'll explain a little bit of that later. Back in 1995, we published a front-page article in Veritas newspaper entitled BATF IRS Criminal Fraud. And we outlined some, just some of the things that we discovered when we investigated the origins of and the legality or criminality of the Internal Revenue Service and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. What we discovered was amazing. And not to mention that it sure made a lot of people in the Internal Revenue Service, the Department of the Treasury in Washington, D.C., very angry with me. Now, tonight I'm going to read you a letter that was sent out by Dan Metter, who's a very good researcher into the law and the income tax and a whole bunch of other things. And the letter, the subject of the letter, is the article that I wrote and that we ran as the headline story in Veritas in 1995. And so tonight you'll get Dan Metter's comments on that story. And then beginning tomorrow night, I'm going to read you the entire story. Remember, what you're going to hear is just some of the results of the investigation. The story was written as a revelation of the compilation of the research of me and a man named Wayne Benson, who lives in Payson, Arizona. We pooled what we had learned over years of looking into these things, and the result was the story that I wrote and published as the lead article in Veritas in 1995. So here we go with the letter from Dan Metter. Please pay attention because Dan contributes more information as a prelude to reading the article so that you might understand it a little bit better. And he sent this out to all of his, the people who are in his research circle and who participate in research with him. Who and what is the IRS? Historical note, history and new evidence that it is a foreign agency. By Dan Metter, April 1st, 2000. Evan, you all know Evan, I've talked about him before, forwarded the following article by Bill Cooper, published in the September 1995 issue of Veritas newspaper. Since I'm suffering the fatigue of not getting home from Tulsa until the wee hours of the morning, and can't seem to get kick-started to do what I should be doing, I'm going to take the opportunity to provide context for the lengthy Cooper article and add information gleaned from research since. For those who haven't seen it, the Cooper article should be enlightening. Additionally, evidence revealed in my portion of this compiled article is going to floor many readers. However, before disclosing new evidence, I'm going to present something of a history. Now listen careful, very carefully, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure that you follow this and take notes if you need to. Gail and I had just finished what we called the Monster Tax Index when someone sent the Cooper article via fax shortly after it was published in September 1995. Our index went through the Internal Revenue Code section by section, listing regulations as they appear in the parallel table of authorities and rules. Then we listed the regulation headings for the regulations. Because of our index, I was able to verify many of the references in the Cooper article without having to go to actual texts. And what I found was that many Cooper-Benson conclusions were verified by the index. Of particular importance, we found that there are no implementing regulations for 26 United States Code Section 7621 which authorizes the president to establish revenue districts. Consequently, there are no revenue districts in states of the Union. However, there was a significant gap in Cooper Benson research. At that point, they hadn't found origins of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico. Well, that's not true, folks. I had found definite origins for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, and I gave them plenty of opportunity to find that in the article. And I did, of course, not publish everything because it's a lengthy article to begin with, and if we published everything, it would have been a book. Continuing, and this is Dan Metter speaking. I documented it in late 1998, even though I knew where to look when I read the Downs versus Bidwell decision in 1997. The first civil governor of Puerto Rico established five bureaus in the Puerto Rico Department of Treasury on May 1, 1900. The five bureaus were eventually to become the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, predecessor to the Internal Revenue Service. The name change of BIR to IRS was in 1953 in advance of implementing the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, based on Reorganization Plan 26 of 1950 and Reorganization Plan 1 of 1952. Early Puerto Rico legislation, beginning with the Gubernatorial and Executive Committee Acts of May 1900, are published in Senate documents for the period, so it's just a matter of going through the publications to complete the merger history. Benson and Cooper located origins of the Bureau of Internal Revenue Philippines and the Philippines Special Fund in 1904, in 1904 documents. The Philippines gained independence in 1946, leaving BIR Puerto Rico as the only Bureau of Internal Revenue that was legislatively created and not by Congress at that. The first Puerto Rico legislature in 1901 legislatively enacted executive acts of May 1900, and we disclosed the existence of the Bureau of Internal Revenue Trust Fund, number 62, in our article of September 1995. In 1934, this is, that was me just speaking, this is Dan Metter speaking again. In 1934, Congress stipulated that the various special funds maintained by the Department of the Treasury would be known as trusts. In effect, Philippines Trusts 1 and 2 and Puerto Rico Trust number 62, all three of which are still in the books in Title 31 of the United States Code. In his article, Cooper cites the Federal Register and the Internal Revenue Manual acknowledgement that Congress never created a Bureau of Internal Revenue. Someone else has since located a Supreme Court decision where justices of the Supreme Court affirm that Congress never created a Bureau of Internal Revenue or Internal Revenue Service. Consequently, the Internal Revenue Service has no lawful authority to enforce anything in the Union, as Congress is charged with responsibility for establishing any government, department, or agency that the Constitution itself does not establish. At the tail end of this article, we're going to share disclosures attorneys in Illinois and Idaho have secured that constitute astounding revelations that should give everyone cause to rethink strategy relating to the Internal Revenue Service. I will continue the account of the research effort that lays the factual foundation. In the historical account by the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, published in the Federal Register and the Internal Revenue Manual, the Commissioner alleges that Congress clearly intended to create a Bureau of Internal Revenue in 1862 legislation that established the Office of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. But reading the 1862 legislation reveals that there was no need for a Bureau of Internal Revenue or Internal Revenue Service. And indeed, this is me speaking now, Congress never created either one. It doesn't make any difference what Congress intended to do. It only makes a difference what Congress actually did or did not do. And in this instance, regardless of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue's assertions, Congress did not create any Bureau of Internal Revenue or any Internal Revenue Service. But reading the 1862 legislation reveals that there was no need for a Bureau of Internal Revenue or Internal Revenue Service. Congress established the offices of assessors and collectors, with one of each to be appointed for each revenue district. These offices were on the order of current U.S. attorneys' appointments. They were political patronage positions. The offices continued to exist until implementation of Reorganization Plan No. 26 of 1950. In order to understand what happened, excuse me, folks, still fighting a little congestion here. In order to understand what happened via the reorganization plans behind the current Internal Revenue Code, we need to review what happened with respect to Prohibition. In 1933, the 21st Amendment repealed the 18th. However, federal enforcement people continued to enforce state laws relating to alcohol to the point of the Constantine decision in December 1935. In the decision, the Supreme Court said that once the 18th Amendment was repealed, state and federal enforcement ceased to have concurrent jurisdiction for enforcement of alcohol-related laws, as the 18th Amendment contained the grant of authority. Once it was repealed, concurrent jurisdiction was repealed, and the United States government no longer had any jurisdiction within the territorial boundaries of the states pertaining to the enforcement of alcohol laws. Until summer 1935, the feds had operated on the Alcohol Administration Act of 1926. That was replaced by the Federal Alcohol Administration Act of 1935, enacted that summer several months in advance of the Constantine decision. In the wake of the Constantine decision, a director was appointed, but the Federal Alcohol Administration wasn't established to administer the Alcohol Administration Act. Via Reorganization Plan No. 3 of 1940, administration of the Federal Alcohol Administration Act was transferred to the Bureau of Internal Revenue, predecessor of the Internal Revenue Service. And as you learned before, that is an office of Puerto Rico. As the Cooper article suggests, Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, and our Bureau of Internal Revenue, Philippines, had already encroached into states of the Union via the China Trade Act legislation, which implemented maritime or customs laws relating to trade in opium, cocaine, and citric wines. That's opium, cocaine, and citric wines. The first drug-related law was passed in 1914. Then, with the 1918 amendment, the feds began to enforce drug laws in the several states. Now, this is why, ladies and gentlemen, and this is not Dan Netter. Now, this is me, William Cooper. This is why, when you seek out through the Freedom of Information Act and are actually able to obtain your master file from the Internal Revenue Service, you will find there are codes in there that, when you have the proper IRS manual to decode them, it says that you are being taxed because you are dealing in the importation of opium, cocaine, and or citric wines. Nobody could figure that out until we published the article. Back to Dan Netter. The timing was ideal. There was significant political mobilization responsible for the 18th Amendment and alcohol prohibition. So the feds took advantage of empathy for purging any kind of intoxicating substance. In his letter supporting the 1940 reorganization plan, Roosevelt said that the Bureau of Internal Revenue had been enforcing provisions of the Federal Alcohol Administration Act. Anyway, so the transfer of responsibility didn't effect significant change. Sometime before Cooper wrote his article, I read the 1992 New York versus United States decision. In the decision, the Supreme Court used the term cooperative federalism. My response was, what the hell is cooperative federalism? And as an aside here, folks, if you get into studying the law concerning the Internal Revenue Service, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Secret Service, and the way they do business, and how they operate under color of law, you'll find all kinds of things that that will make you have the same response. What the hell is that? Back to Dan Meador. The next time I saw published use of the term was in the title of an article in the 1992 edition of The Book of the States. In the meantime, I ran across the Federalism Executive Order Ronald Reagan put in place. The Reagan Order, which technically preserves constitutional integrity, is the one Bill Clinton kept trying to overhaul, but he is getting considerable resistance. This particular executive order is an executive policy statement. It doesn't meet standards of 3 United States Code, Section 301, and the Federal Register Act. It is simply the prevailing policy statement that informally shapes relations between state and federal government. Now we have two essential identifying terms. On the federal side, federalism, and on the state side, cooperative federalism. Now let's address the scheme of things through two constitutional questions. Have Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 5 and 6, and Article 1, Section 10, Paragraph 1 of the Constitution been repealed or amended? Has the Constitution been amended to effect prohibition against opium, cocaine, and other such substances? We'll follow those questions with two more. Do we have gold and silver coin as our national currency? Do we have national prohibition against drugs? In light of the first two questions, we can conclude that Congress has defaulted responsibility for providing a national currency of gold and silver coin, and our states of the Union are accommodating the fraud without a constitutional amendment. And in light of the second question, we can conclude that federal government is exercising a power which is not enumerated in the Constitution, and our respective state governments are accommodating the usurpation of power. Obviously, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was patently unconstitutional. At least it was if it applied to union, but it might not be if it applied to United States government itself and territories and insular possessions of the United States. Likewise, the federal drug laws would be legitimate if they applied to the District of Columbia and insular possessions of the United States. It is here that Congress has plenary or near absolute power, and we can lengthen the list. The Federal Alcohol Administration Act is legitimate in Puerto Rico, but not in Oklahoma. Likewise, the Social Security Act of 1935 is legitimate in Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, etc., but not in Kansas. Where the latter is concerned, we see proper geographical application and definitions of state, United States, and citizen at 26 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 31.3121, small e-6. At the January 1937 General Conference of the Council of State Governments, delegates from a majority of our state legislatures endorsed the Declaration of Intergovernmental Dependence. This formalized what was already a working arrangement. States of the Union formally went on the federal dole system, and by setting up the infrastructure, provided a forum for general agreement among state governing bodies as to what federal encroachment they would accommodate. Now, as an aside here, folks, the federal government is a state. Each separate state of the Union is also a state, independent and sovereign, except where it's given power in the Constitution for the United States of America to the federal government. Now, since each state of the Union is a state, and since the federal government is a state, this kind of arrangement and agreement is prohibited by the Constitution, which clearly says the states of the Union will not enter into any treaty with any other state. A treaty is an agreement or a contract entered into by two or more states. These kinds of agreements, resulting in cooperative federalism, are, in fact, treaties which are forbidden by the Constitution, and therefore they are unlawful, unconstitutional, and in fact, when they encroach upon the rights of the citizens and of the sovereignty of each individual state, they are treasonous. Treasonous. Back to Dan Metter. Here are more relevant questions. Does the executive branch have legislative authority? Can the president unilaterally repeal law once it has been formally enacted by Congress? Via Reorganization Plan No. 3 of 1940, Roosevelt reassigned duties of the Federal Alcohol Administration to the Bureau of Internal Revenue, thereby abandoning the agency Congress established. Then, via Reorganization Plan No. 26 of 1950, Truman effectively terminated the offices of assessor and collector Congress established in 1862. In other words, after the Supreme Court determined that federal enforcement agencies had no authority to enforce state alcohol law in the several states, administration of the Federal Alcohol Administration Act was moved under authority of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, for administration in insular possessions of the United States. By law, the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, could not be exercised in the Union, but since state governments were willing to accommodate federal encroachment in return for whatever financial incentives federal government provided, the fraud was and has generally been accommodated. The scheme worked well enough that in 1950, Truman followed the Roosevelt lead by authorizing Bureau of Internal Revenue, in effect, the Internal Revenue Service, administration of federal income tax law. But the geographical application remains the same, limited to the District of Columbia and insular possessions of the United States. Any encroachment into the territorial boundary of any of the several states of the Union is not only unconstitutional, it's unlawful, it is a fraud, it is treason. Through their gross income source research, Tupper Saucy, Thurston Bell, Larkin Rose, and various others have documented that the American people in general are liable for federal income tax, but are liable only on income from foreign sources and insular possessions of the United States. These conclusions reinforce and are consistent with my research and the research by Benson and Cooper. With enactment of the Internal Revenue Code of 1954 via Truman Executive Orders, the offices of Assessor and Collector of Internal Revenue were terminated, and administration of the Internal Revenue Code by appearance was turned over to the Internal Revenue Service, an agency of the Department of the Treasury, Puerto Rico. We need to address one more entity, the United States of America. What is the United States of America? As it turns out, there are two entities called the United States of America. The first, an original, mentioned in the preamble and Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States, was formally created in the Articles of Confederation. But sometime after the Civil War, probably early in the 20th century, a second United States of America came into being. The second is a political alliance or compact of the insular possessions of the United States. Here I'm going to introduce evidence secured by John M. Oman, that's spelled capital O-H-M-A-N, that's capital O, lowercase H-M-A-N, an Idaho Falls, Idaho attorney. In the case styled Diversified Metal Products Incorporated versus Tebow Company Trust, Internal Revenue Service, and Steve Morgan, case capital C, capital V, 93-4117, filed in the District Court of the 7th Judicial District of the State of Idaho, the Boonville County Magistrates Court, Oman filed an impleader petition. This is the same case that I read to you, I think it was a week ago. Diversified Metal was served a notice of levy for money owed to the Tebow Trust. In order to determine rightful ownership, Oman filed the interpleader action on behalf of Diversified Metal. In his complaint, he stipulated facts. His fact number 4 is as follows. Defendant Internal Revenue Service, IRS, is an agency of the United States government. In her January 24, 2000 response, U.S. Attorney Betty H. Richardson made the following correction to Oman's averment. Here's what she said, I read it to you, in her response number 4, denies that the Internal Revenue Service is an agency of the United States government, but admits that the United States of America would be a proper party to this action. And remember, folks, this is me now, not Dan Metter. Remember I talked to you about that, that these are all different entities. Back to Dan Metter. This is something I've tried to impress on people for almost 2 years, but few grasp the implications. The Constitution for the United States creates and vests authority in a governmental entity known as the United States or United States government. While it is for the United States of America, the Constitution vests absolutely no authority in the United States of America. Anytime the United States prosecutes as case, whether civil or criminal, it must be in the name and by authority of the United States, not the United States of America. The only place the United States of America has any standing is in territorial courts in insular possessions of the United States. Then the styling must be United States of America, SS, comma, President of the United States. See Title 48 of the United States Code for particulars relating to Puerto Rican and Virgin Island courts. And I will add also that it also applies to Guam courts. If we read notes following the current 18 United States Code, Section 1001, we find that the United States of America is currently defined as an agency of the United States. In the context of the Downs versus Bidwell decision, we find that these insular possessions, which are not incorporated in the constitutional scheme, are foreign, foreign, foreign to the United States, in effect, to the Union of States. Therefore, this political alliance or compact, known as the United States of America, which first appeared in 1918 legislation, is a government foreign to the United States and the several states, even though the member insular possessions belong to the United States. The Richardson correction verifies that the Internal Revenue Service is not an agency of the United States government, but the United States of America, clearly a distinct and different entity, would be a party of interest. It would be difficult to be any clearer on the subject, and the Richardson correction tells us that people such as U.S. attorneys, attorneys in the Department of Justice, and federal judges are fully aware of the difference. And this is me talking again, just like I've been telling you for years and years and years. Continue with Dan Mitter's letter. Michael Bufkin, a Dundee, Illinois attorney, undertook a delightful project on December 18, 1998. He sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the Department of Treasury asking for documentation of authority for the Department of Justice to defend Internal Revenue Service personnel in civil or criminal cases. In an August 2, 1999 response, Leslie Howard in the National Internal Revenue Service office responded with the following. A search was performed with the Office of Tax Crimes Criminal Investigation and with the Assistant Chief Counsel Disclosure Litigation, and we have no documents responsible to your request. However, you may forward a copy of your request to the U.S. Attorney General's office within the Department of Justice. Well, Bufkin did just that. In response to his September 21, 1999 FOIA to the Attorney General, Thomas J. McIntyre informed Bufkin that we have conducted a search of the appropriate indices to criminal division records and did not locate any records responsive to your request. We don't know who has lawful authority to defend IRS personnel, but the Department of Justice and U.S. attorneys don't. Possibly the foreign United States of America, that is principal of interest and benefits from IRS initiatives, has a raft of attorneys ready to defend these foreign agents. As chance would have it, one of the people in our group recently received certification of documents on Internal Revenue Service Austin Region stationery that is headed United States of America, comma, Department of the Treasury, comma, Internal Revenue Service. The certification letters are dated November 16, 1999. What we are dealing with amounts to invasion of a foreign government accommodated by our respective state governments. However, thanks to the diligence of people approaching IRS tyranny from several directions, we about have the whole nut documented and broken down. With the context of what I've written, the Cooper article that follows will have more significance. Signed, Dan Mitter, Ponca City, Oklahoma. I'm going to play a little music now so I can take a drink of coffee, and then we'll start the article. It's going to take a couple of nights to get through it. It's long. It's lengthy. There are a lot of legal sites. You should have pen and paper by your side. You should be listening very carefully, and you should take notes. You can do that, can't you? Take notes, I mean? I think so. We'll be right back. here we go, folks. I hope you're all settled in and got pen and paper by your side, ready to listen. This article was originally published in the September edition of Veritas National Newspaper as the headline article. It made history because up until Wayne Benson and I pooled our research and I wrote this article, everybody had come to a dead end, a brick wall. They weren't able to go any further because they could not find the true nature of the Internal Revenue Service. In fact, they couldn't even find that it existed in the United States government. And that, folks, is because it does not. So listen very, very carefully. And write. You must write. And you must duplicate the research so that you know that I'm not lying to you. See, unless you get off your butt and go out and do the research yourself, like I've always told you, listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research, you'll never know whether I'm sitting here feeding you the biggest crock of crap that you ever heard in your life or whether I'm telling you the truth. Now, I am telling you the truth, but you've got to verify that on your own. You can't take my word for it. This is the age of deception. Believing and trusting people is what got us to this point. And it's wrong to do that. IRS BATF Criminal Fraud by William Cooper, with research combined between myself and Wayne Benson. Quote, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. End quote. Constitution for the United States of America, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 1. Now, the United States of America, I just quoted to you, is not the same United States of America that is the Union of the Insular Possessions that represents the foreign power that is encroaching upon the states. Quote, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. End quote. Constitution for the United States of America, Article 1, Section 9, Paragraph 4. Investigation of the alleged Internal Revenue Service and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has disclosed a broad, premeditated conspiracy to defraud the citizens of the United States of America. Examination of the United States Code, the Code of Federal Regulations, the statutes at large, congressional record, the Federal Register, and Internal Revenue manuals too numerous to list, reveals a crime of such magnitude that words cannot adequately describe the betrayal of the American people. What we have uncovered has clearly been designed to circumvent the limitations of the Constitution for the United States and implement the Communist Manifesto within the 50 states. Marx and Engels claimed that in the effort to create a classless society, a graduated income tax could be used as a weapon to destroy the middle class. Magic is the art of illusion. Those who practice magic are called magi. They have created a web of obfuscation and confusion in the law. When the courts have ruled them unconstitutional or unlawful, they merely stepped outside jurisdiction and venue by fooling the people. They continue the crime. These magicians have convinced Americans that we have a status we do not. We are led to believe we must do things that are not required. Through the clever use of language, the government promotes fraud. The Bureau of Internal Revenue and the alleged Internal Revenue Service were not created by Congress. These are not organizations or agencies of the Department of the Treasury or of the federal government. They appear to be operated through pure trusts administered by the Secretary of the Treasury, the trustee. The settler of the trust and the beneficiary, our beneficiaries, are unknown. According to the law governing trusts, the information does not have to be revealed. The organization, listen to me carefully, folks. You can go check this out real easy. All of this, you can check it out real easy. I'll give you sites for everything. The organization of the Department of the Treasury can be found in 31 United States Code. That's 31 United States Code, Chapter 3. You will not find the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the Internal Revenue Service, the Secret Service, or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms listed as they must be listed as required by law. But they are not. We learned that the Bureau of Internal Revenue, Internal Revenue, Internal Revenue Service, Internal Revenue Service, and I'm saying the same thing, but in the law, they are different depending upon capitalization. So when I say the Bureau of Internal Revenue and then Internal Revenue, that's Internal Revenue with no capitalization, and then Internal Revenue Service with capital I, capital R, small s, and then Internal Revenue Service with no capitalization, Official Internal Revenue Service with capital O, capital I, capital R, capital S, the Federal Alcohol Administration, Director Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms are all one organization. We found this obfuscated but definitely proved in the law. And you're going to hear the cites, so listen. The investigation found that except for the very few who are engaged in specific activities, the citizens of the 50 states of the United States of America have never been required to file or to pay income taxes. The federal government is engaging in constructive fraud on a massive scale. Americans who have been frightened into filing and paying income taxes have been robbed of their money. Millions of lives have been ruined. Hundreds of thousands of innocent people have been imprisoned on the pretense they violated laws that do not exist. Some have been driven to suicide. Marriages have been destroyed. Property has been confiscated to pay taxes that were never owed. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln imposed a war tax upon the citizens. The war tax lawfully applied only to those citizens who resided within the Federal District of Columbia and federally owned territories, dockyards, naval bases, or forts, and those who were considered to be in rebellion against the Union. This was done by executive order, not by legislation passed by the Congress. Many citizens of the several states volunteered to pay. After the war, the tax was repealed. This left the impression that the President and Congress could levy an unapportioned direct tax upon citizens of the several states when, in fact, no such tax had ever been imposed. The tax was not fraud, as nothing was done to deceive the people. Those who were deceived, in fact, deceived themselves. In the last century, the United States acquired by conquest the territory of the Philippine Islands, Guam, and Puerto Rico. The Philippine Customs Administrative Act was passed by the Philippine Commission during the period from September 1, 1900 to August 31, 1902, to regulate trade with foreign countries and to create revenue in the form of duties, imposts, and excises. The act created the federal government's first trust fund, called Trust Fund No. 1, the Philippine Special Fund, Customs and Duties. 31 United States Code, Section 1321. The act was administered under the general supervision and control of the Secretary of Finance and Justice. The Philippine Commission passed another act known as the Internal Revenue Law of 1904. This act created the Bureau of Internal Revenue and the federal government's second trust fund, Internal Revenue, 31 United States Code, Section 1321. In the Act, Article 1, Section 2, we find, quote, "There shall be established a Bureau of Internal Revenue, the chief officer of which bureau shall be known as the Collector of Internal Revenue. He shall be appointed by the civil governor, with the advice and consent of the Philippine Commission, and shall receive a salary at the rate of 8,000 pesos per annum. The Bureau of Internal Revenue shall belong to the Department of Finance and Justice," end quote. And in Section 3 we find, quote, "The Collector of Internal Revenue, under the direction of the Secretary of Finance and Justice, shall have general superintendence of the assessment and collection of all tax and excises imposed by this Act or by any Act amendatory thereof, and shall perform such other duties, as may be required by law," end quote. It was clear that the Customs Administrative Act was to fall within the jurisdiction of the Bureau of the Internal Revenue, which Bureau was to be responsible for all taxes and excise imposed by this Act, which clearly include import and export excise taxes. This effectively merged Customs and Internal Revenue in the Philippines. When Prohibition was ratified in 1919 with the 18th Amendment, the government created federal bureaucracies to enforce the outlaw of alcohol. As protest and resistance to Prohibition increased, so did new federal laws and the number of bureaucrats hired to enforce them. After much bloodshed and public anger, Prohibition was repealed with the 21st Amendment, which was ratified in 1933. In 1933, President Roosevelt declared a banking emergency. The Congress gave the President dictatorial powers under the War Powers Act of 1917. Congress used the economic emergency as the excuse to give blanket approval to any and all presidential executive orders. Roosevelt, with a little help from his socialist friends, was prolific in his production of new legislation and legislation through executive orders, an unconstitutional act. But he cranked them out. In 1935, the Public Administration Clearinghouse wrote, and Roosevelt introduced, the Federal Alcohol Act. Congress passed it into law. The act established the Federal Alcohol Administration. But that same year, the Supreme Court, in a monumental ruling, struck down the Act, among many others on a long list of draconian and New Deal laws. The Federal Alcohol Administration did not go away. It became involved in other affairs, placed in a sort of standby status. At some unknown date prior to 1940, another Bureau of Internal Revenue was established in Puerto Rico. The 62nd Trust Fund was created and named Trust Fund No. 62, Puerto Rico Special Fund Internal Revenue. Note that the Puerto Rico Special Fund has Internal Revenue capital I and capital R. The Philippine Special Fund Internal Revenue is all in lowercase letters. Between 1904 and 1938, the China Trade Act was passed to deal with opium, cocaine, and citric wines shipped out of China. It appears to have been administered in the Philippines by the Bureau of Internal Revenue. We studied a copy of the Code of Federal Registrations of the United States of America in force June 1, 1938, Title 26, Internal Revenue, Chapter 1, Parts 1 through 137, on page 65, it makes reference to the China Trade Act, where the first use of such terms as income, credits, withholding, assessment, and collection deficiencies, extension of time for payment, and failure to file return appeared. The entire substance of Title 26 deals with foreign individuals, foreign corporations, foreign insurance corporations, foreign ships, income from sources within possessions of the United States, citizens of the United States and domestic corporations deriving income from sources within a possession of the United States, and China Trade Act corporations. Do any of those apply to any of you? They certainly don't apply to me. All of the taxes covered by these laws concerned the imposts, excise taxes, and duties to be collected by the Bureau of Internal Revenue for such items as narcotics, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. The alleged Internal Revenue Service likes to make a big to-do about the fact that Al Capone was jailed for tax evasion. The IRS will not tell you that the tax Capone evaded was not income tax as we know it, but the tax due on the income from the alcohol which he had imported from Canada. If he had paid the tax, he would not have been convicted and would probably be running some very large multinational corporation today. The Internal Revenue Act of 1939 was clearly concerned with all taxes, imposts, excises, and duties collected on trade between the possessions and territories of the United States and foreign individuals, foreign corporations, or foreign governments. The income tax laws have always applied only to the Philippines, Puerto Rico, District of Columbia, U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, territories, and insular possessions. Under the Reorganization Plan No. 3 of 1940, which appears at 5 United States Code Service 903, the Federal Alcohol Administration and offices of members and administrators thereof were abolished and their functions directed to be administered under direction and supervision of Secretary of Treasury through Bureau of Internal Revenue. We found this history in all of the older editions of 27 United States Code Service, Section 201. It has been removed from current editions so that you can't find this out. Only two bureaus of internal revenue have ever existed in the history of this country, one in the Philippines and another in Puerto Rico. Events that have transpired tell us that the Federal Alcohol Administration was, in fact, absorbed by the Puerto Rico Trust No. 62, Internal Revenue, Puerto Rico, because the Philippine Islands were granted their independence and we no longer have jurisdiction over that, what used to be our territory. Don't forget to tune in tomorrow night, folks, as we continue. Make sure you have your pad and pencil by your side because I'm going to blow your brains out with this information. And I cite everything. And unless you've gone and looked it up and can prove me to be wrong, don't you ever let me hear you call me a liar. Because I'll make you look like a fool. Good night. God bless each and every single one of you. Good night, Annie Poo and Allison. I love you. Remember, folks, if the only reason that you file an income tax return and pay the income tax is that you're afraid of the Internal Revenue Service, that means this country was history a long time ago, and this is nothing but a nation of miserable cowards. Think about that. And if you don't believe there's no law, call the Internal Revenue Service and ask them to quote you the law, and then make sure you look it up and make sure that it applies to you. It will usually say something like, those made liable must file a Form 1040. Where you go wrong, folks, is you assume that you are one of those made liable. When you start looking in the code to find out who's made liable, you find out it's not you at all. Stop being dummies. Wake up. Wake up. Take back our country under constitutional Republican government. Seek out and join a militia. If you can't find one, form one of your own. And if you don't believe it's lawful, look in the law. Most of you are already members of the militia by law, and you don't even know. Because you're ignorant. There's nothing wrong with being ignorant. But once you're confronted with the facts and you won't go to the law and confirm it, that makes you stupid. And you don't want to be stupid, believe me. Listening, the hour of the time, you're truly William Cooper, according to William Jefferson Clinton, the most dangerous radio host in America. And now you know why. Folks, if you don't miss not even one episode of The Hour of the Time, between now and beyond April 15th, as we expose the criminality, the unconstitutionality, the treason, the subversion, and the terror brought to this country by the Nazi jackbooted Gestapo thugs of the Internal Revenue Service and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Thank you.